Here's why you need to attend the Recruitment Coach Live Summit in London this September. Reason number one is networking. The opportunity to connect in person with like-minded recruitment business owners and share strategies and best practices. Of course, you can do that via Zoom or Teams, but the connection is deeper when you do it in real life. Wouldn't you agree? One of our previous attendees, Darcy, said that she loved the speakers and the content, but the best part for her was in between the sessions, the informal conversations with other successful business owners that sparked incredible insights and those aha moments. The quality of people in the room will be incredible, including many of the people you've heard me interview on this podcast. There's going to be big billing recruiters as well as business owners with multi-million pound businesses. What they all have in common is that they prioritize their own development. And no matter how successful they already are, they want to keep learning and growing. What's even more special and remarkable about this group is that they're all willing to share their knowledge and they're so generous at helping each other improve. Early bird pricing is still available. Register now by visiting recruitmentcoach.com/summit. Welcome to the Resilient Recruiter Podcast. This is your host, Mark Whitby. I'm delighted to be joined today by Frido Diepenveen. Born in the Netherlands.
Well pronounced.
Oh, thank you. I practiced that, Frido. Hopefully I can say it right the next time as well. Frido was born in the Netherlands and trained as a lawyer before discovering his true passion was in recruitment and executive search. That was in 2005 when he co-founded a recruiting firm that he and his business partner grew to 55 employees before selling it to Randstad in 2010. After that transaction, Frido stayed on the board as commercial director and helped the new owners to grow the business with 20 to 30% year-on-year growth and actually stayed with them until 2018, which is when he decided to start a new recruiting firm from scratch. So now Frido is the managing director of Diepenveen and Partners, a boutique search firm with a team of 15 based in Budapest, Hungary, and serving clients throughout Europe and North America. So Frido, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you very much, Mark. And I'm truly excited to be on your show. I've followed several of your podcasts, and I feel honored that I may be here. And am I the first non-native English speaker?
No, I've had a few Dutch entrepreneurs on the show, actually.
I missed those.
Yeah, I can point them out to you. But no, so not the first, but one of the few, let's say.
Yeah. Okay. Then, as I am a lawyer and Dutch Hungarian, let me make use of the opportunity to have a disclaimer.
Okay.
Because as the English language is not my mother tongue, should I say anything funny, please disregard it or forgive me for it.
We will, because, absolutely. Yeah. But I do not think that will be an issue.
Okay.
Absolutely. So,
and Mark, please allow me to correct you a little
bit. Okay, please.
Perhaps my information was not 100% precise or you misunderstood. I did not co-found ProfiPower. I joined after it had been founded, but I was employee number 8 or so. And together with Ilonka Jankovic, we built out the company. And after 2 weeks of me joining the firm, she told me, you're going to be my deputy managing director. And if things go well, I will allow you to have equity in the company. So, but I was not founding it myself.
I understand.
I found it
Thank
important
you for clarifying.
To say, yeah.
I yeah. misunderstood the background. Yeah. So thanks for clarifying that. And so we're going to get into that business in just a second. First, can you tell me how you were referred by Abid Hamid from Recruitment Entrepreneur? How do you know Abid?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that has to do with this company called ProfiPower, because when I joined this firm in March 2005, my employment started with a 2-day training. And guess who was the trainer? Abid Hamid. And telling this to my colleagues nowadays, I say, I could not have had a better start than with this fantastic training, where he led us through the 30 steps of recruitment, the ABC of this profession. And Abid has been inspiring me since then till today.
Amazing. Wow. So you've had a very long association with Abid. And yeah, he's trained, generations of recruiters. So fantastic. Well, I'm glad he's put us in touch with each other. So tell me, you originally were working in banking. You were in-house counsel at ABN AMRO, which is one of the biggest banks in the world. What inspired or what motivated you to transition from banking into recruitment?
I'll be very honest with you. When I was at high school, I didn't have a clue what profession to choose or what studies to choose. I studied European studies in the beginning, and after a while, it turned out to be something educating people for a secretary job, with all respect. And I thought that's not going to be my career.
Got it.
It was a combination of languages and economics, but not very deep. And I was part of a fraternity in Amsterdam, and my fellow students said, well, if you don't know what to study, study law. And that was said on a Friday evening in a pub. And I said, why not? And I liked law studies as such. And I'm still happy that I did it, because it gives you a very good framework. It gives you a very good view on society. And it's very helpful in certain situations. But soon I found out that this is not going to be my profession. Nevertheless, when finishing my studies, I was introduced by a professor of labor law to ABN AMRO. And I did not pass the interview at all of legal affairs. This was in 98, when there was still lack of talent in the Netherlands. The economy was booming, going through the roof. And they liked me as a person. So I said, well, you don't have a real passion for legal affairs, it seems. You don't have a clue why you would like to join ABN AMRO, but you're a nice guy, so let's try. Wow. I said, why not? Yeah. Very different days today, of course, but in those days, this was the case. So I joined the bank in legal affairs. I had to deal with insolvency clients. In those days, as I said, the economy was going very well, and there were not so many exciting insolvencies, so the job was boring, to be honest. Now, you have to know that I'm a quarter Hungarian, and my wife, my first wife, I have to say, Hungarian, she did not like the Netherlands. So I thought, why not make use of this situation and move to the country I've always loved as a tourist? And start a new career. So after, I think, 2 years of legal affairs, ABN AMRO, I moved to Hungary. And as you can imagine, in Hungary, they were not so interested in Dutch insolvency law. And I was a lawyer according to the Dutch law, but not according to the Hungarian legislation. I didn't speak Hungarian yet. I was offered the opportunity to go to law school and join Clifford Chance, but I would have had to start from scratch or over again. So I said, okay, change of career, change of plan. And through a contact, I joined ING Bank. And there I found out how important networking is. Because through a fraternity friend, his father is a important person in the Dutch economy. He referred me to the CEO, the group CEO of ING Bank, who told the CEO in Hungary, a Dutch guy, hire this person, whatever you do. So they were, they had to hire me in a job. And it was a very strange period, because the Hungarian lady who was going to be my boss said, sorry, but you're being completely useless for me. You don't speak the language. You don't know anything about the Hungarian banking industry. So what shall I do with you? She said, I know that I have to hire you, but really, I can't do anything with you. But she said, if you manage to learn the Hungarian language within 6 months and you learn the basics of the banking industry, I will support you. Well, you can imagine.
That was very fair, really, to give you that opportunity.
Yes, and we can say that it was almost Dutch straightforward communication.
Yes, Dutch are Hungarians, very straightforward, aren't they?
Yeah. She worked for a Dutch bank, after all. So, looking back, I'm very grateful for that because I took Hungarian lessons. Okay. I read a lot of books about banking. Mm-hmm. And believe it or not, and I have to admit that I'm proud of that, after 6 months, I was talking to the finance directors, clients of the bank in Hungarian, and I was discussing the balance sheet and profit and loss.
Good for you.
And I was asking questions like, why did accounts receivable change from year to year, or what about your net worth? And I had to write analysis about that. So this is how I came into Hungary, which was in those days not part of the EU yet.
Right.
So I needed a residence permit, a working permit. Yeah.
So, Frido, I understand how you ended up in Hungary, but this still doesn't explain how you got into recruitment, which is quite a different thing than getting into banking, right? I need to give a shout out to the guy who writes our show notes. So the text that appears on our website alongside our podcast episodes is called Israel Tabunar. And he moonlights as a freelance writer, but his day job is with ING.
Really?
Coincidentally. So shout out to Iz. And he does a fantastic job of writing for us.
I will explain. Yeah. I'll try to make it compact. So I did 2 years of credit analysis, which was interesting. So I learned how to read a balance sheet and profit and loss and how to make analysis. So that's, again, just as my legal studies, very interesting and useful information and knowledge. But I came to the conclusion that this was too dry for me. So my boss said, understood, now you know the basics of banking, why not go to the commercial side and sell banking products? Now, dealing with clients and people was already much more interesting, and of course the sales and consultancy part.
Mm-hmm.
And then 3 years later, I thought, well, selling revolving credits and bank guarantees is again too dry to me.
I can understand that.
Yeah, and my belief is that if you're not completely interested in something, if you're not passionate about something, you can never be really good at it.
True, I agree.
So I said I have to change again, and as Abid used to say, good things often happen by accident, and perhaps this was not even an accident, but I ran into Ilonka Jankovic, whom I already knew from the Netherlands. She's Dutch-Hungarian. And she told me that she had just set up, autumn 2004, a recruitment firm in Hungary. In those days, I hardly knew what a recruitment firm was because I had never had to do with it. I was always asked for jobs. And she said, it's in the startup phase. Why don't you join? I looked after a bit more deeply after Ilonka. I found out that she is a very serious businesswoman. She had set up Legal Flex Force, which she sold for a record amount to a TMP.
Oh, wow. That's interesting.
Just before 9/11. I knew she was very serious. I thought if I join her, it can't be any bad to me. And she came to Hungary, being half Hungarian and having a husband who is a writer and can write anywhere in the world, to do the trick again. And you have to know that in 2004, 2005, of course, we were told the market is saturated. There's no place for another recruitment firm. By the way, in Hungary, until the end of communism, there was not really such a thing like executive search or recruiter.
Of course.
So it was a new business, but they said it's full. And believe it or not, between 2005 and 2008, we managed to become market leaders in Hungary.
Wow.
And that was a fantastic time of building up a firm, getting in a client day by day. Fantastic. Fantastic.
Amazing.
So I immediately loved the profession from the very start.
Got it. So I want to concentrate primarily on what you're doing now, but just if you were to recap on the kind of key lessons that you learned, or the key things that you gained from that experience, that first experience in recruitment of helping Ilonka to build up the business and leading to the transaction with Randstad. What would be the top two or three things?
I think what made us the market leaders in Hungary is that our service was just much better, higher quality, faster, and more personal. So I see changes on the Hungarian market, but yeah, the country has had 50 years of communism or socialism, as they sometimes call it, where it was not really needed to sell. So the service mind, the service orientation, is often lacking in Hungary. And we, as Dutch Hungarians, knowing also the Western way of selling and the client orientation, we could easily win clients for us to show how you can also do it. And I think what a lot of clients liked then and still like is that the Dutch are often very entrepreneurial and thinking out of the box, and rather thinking in opportunities than something is not possible. And I say it a bit silently now, but Hungarians can be a bit pessimistic and melancholic, and often things are okay. Not possible. And then we said, yeah, of course it's possible. We are going to solve it for you. And that approach, where also I have learned from that period that you have to do what you say and say what you do, mm-hmm. was a game changer. And it may sound silly or a surprise, but it was the case.
Frido, you mentioned some things there which I would like to try and quantify or get more specific, because a lot of business people, salespeople, recruiters say things like, we offer more personal service, or we offer, you know, faster results, or we offer, you know, higher quality, you know, yep. service to our competitors. But what, that's intangible. What does
I can
that
make
really
it super tangible.
Okay, great. Please.
I can make it super tangible. I will first tell you the result of this approach, and then I will yes. tell you how I get to the
perfect
result. Many of my clients have become personal friends over the years. Mm. So that about being personal. Now, being personal to me means that you should not see an assignment as just one of the many, but you should consider it as a unique job that you are so lucky to get to work on. So I always try to be humble, and I'm always very pleased when a client gives me the opportunity to solve a problem that he has. And how do I make it personal? Well, I go to the client wherever he is. Next month, I will probably go to Costa Rica for a new assignment. Last week, I was in Barcelona. In December, I will go to Amsterdam. So I don't care about where the client is. I always want to meet the client in person.
Wow, and I hear that's from, interesting.
Yeah, and I hear from my clients that many headhunters do not do that.
No.
Especially not today, when everything or almost everything can be solved through Teams or Zoom.
Yes.
But I want to see where my candidates end up working.
Yes.
Otherwise, how can I sell it in a creditworthy way to the candidates?
I agree 100%. What's different, though, because if you run a local or regional recruiting practice, then that's much easier, right? And we always were trained that you must see the client in person, face to face, to take the order, build a relationship, you know, look at the, you know, the actual building the client, the candidate will be working from, and so on. And that was a sort of non-negotiable. You must every time visit the client in person. But I think that over time, that's less the case, especially in the post-COVID era. But what's unique about you, I don't know many international search firms who have that same policy where you go and visit the client where even in another country. I think that is quite unique.
I couldn't do it in another way. And of course, going to Barcelona from Budapest is an extreme but very pleasant way of doing business, by the way.
Sure.
But I heard so many times from clients in Hungary mm-hmm. that recruiters didn't even take the effort to travel an hour and visit a factory in the countryside.
Right.
I could not do it without it.
Yes.
So that's one of the things to make it personal. Also, right. Another thing, with most clients, I never jumped immediately into the business topic. I choose the path of first getting to know a person, seeing whether there is a certain chemistry, because I have the luxury nowadays after 7 years of recruitment that I can choose whom to work for. I don't want to work for a client I don't like.
Of course, I feel the exact same. Mm.
Yeah. So if I get to know a client and I see that there's some chemistry evolving, then it is so much easier to talk about confidential stuff. If you have a certain chemistry with a person, he will probably trust you after a while and say, listen, actually, I have a big problem. I have to fire my CFO, but I'm not sure whether I can find a good replacement within 2 weeks or so. Huh? And this is one of the ways to build relationships. And another thing that I often do and also tell my colleagues is to also interview candidates that you cannot immediately place for two reasons or three actually. It's good marketing if you can show that you're also helping people you cannot immediately take advantage from.
Yes.
On the other hand, the candidate may not be needed today, but maybe needed tomorrow, and then he is already mm-hmm. in your database. And the third mm-hmm. reason, of course, if you treat a candidate in a very good and personal way, then the person may easily become a client of yours because you have shown how you deal with people.
Mm. I love the specific examples of how you make the service personal.
And I have to hold myself back. Eh? I have many more examples, but we only have 1 hour.
I'd love to hear them. But I just want to... I think most recruiters would agree that what you're describing of interviewing candidates, even if you can't place them today, would be the ideal situation for the reasons that you just said. You know, candidates today become clients tomorrow. You're building a database, which makes it easier to fill jobs in the future, and so on and so forth. The challenge, or what makes that difficult in practice, is time pressure. Recruiters are very target-driven, so you've got targets, you know, for the quarter, for the month. You may have, you know, deadlines from clients. You maybe have multiple assignments that you're under pressure to deliver the short list, and so then the pressing immediate needs of today that have stress and urgency and also money attached to them. Supersede the candidates who you can't really help right now, and so it's I guess my question for you is, how do you allocate or manage the time involved in that? Especially now, like, we're seeing a shift in the market. For the last 2 years, it's been very client-driven. Sorry, very candidate-driven. So the candidate is king, right? We do everything to find, to nurture, to build relationships with the candidates. And the clients, you know, for many recruiters, are almost less important than the candidate. But now we're seeing it shift to the other way, where in many markets, you know, there's a slowing of hiring demand and an increase in, let's say, unemployment, which means that more candidates are coming to you asking for help, advice, you know, and with finding a new opportunity. And then it can become overwhelming for the recruiter. They need to focus on building the client relationships, which is more, the client is the one who pays you the fee, right? So how do you juggle that in a commercially sensible way?
Yeah, very good question. And I often get this from my colleagues as well. I find this, if we only think of today and the cash flow of this month, I find it very short-term thinking. Mm-hmm. And if there's something I've learned from the Profi Power Time and from Ilonka, then it is to think long-term.
Right.
Because you never know what's going to happen in the future. And when you think long-term, you can build long-lasting relationships. And in all honesty, you don't get requests every day from a candidate with whom you could do a generic interview. It doesn't happen every day. And even if it did, of course, you can still select and you can be honest. So I'll give you an example. Sometimes I get foreign state secretaries at my desk, or they would like to sit down with me. And in those cases, if I have time, even then I sit down and keep it short. But often I tell such a person, like, listen, I'm going to be very interesting. I'm happy to give you some advice on writing your CV or so, but I don't think it makes a lot of sense to meet, because I will not be the one who's going to be able to help you, because you have such a specific background. I've never placed a person from a ministry or so. And then normally they accept that, especially if you give CV advice or you say this or that headhunter may be able to help you. And you still give something.
I think that's brilliant.
Yeah. And also you can plan. So if you are working, and that's often the case for a headhunter, on very deadline-focused assignments, you can say, listen, I don't have time now, but next month, third week, I'll be happy to see you. Also an opportunity.
I think the key there is you're being honest, and you're at least getting back to them. I think that's the biggest reason candidates are unhappy, is they don't hear back from a recruiter, right? There's nothing. It's so, even if you're saying, look, I'm not the right person to help you, but at least you've communicated with them. I think that even by itself is, sets you apart.
Now, you mentioned a very important word, honesty.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think that is both my USP and the USP of our company. And it seems to be quite unusual, and it may have to do with my Dutch background, because as I said, the Dutch are very straightforward, sometimes too straightforward. So I think I've also learned from, for instance, the Hungarian culture, that in certain cases it may be good to a little bit pack the message instead of giving it so bluntly black and white as the Dutch often do.
Right.
But still, I'll give you an example, and that concerned a Spanish candidate that I was talking to the other day. And Spanish people are proud people. Spanish men are often kind of macho. So I had already learned that I have to be careful giving the Dutch feedback to a Spanish candidate. But there was this candidate, a lovely guy, and I may see him next time when I'm in Barcelona, because he invited me for drinks and dinner and so on, regardless of of the question whether he will be the winner or not. Very nice guy. And good content, good professional, but a very, very Spanish accent and a relatively badly written CV. And I gave him the feedback, like, listen, my client is actually looking with a person with, let's say, international English. Doesn't have to be Oxford, but it should be good English. And sorry for saying, but you are speaking a kind of Mediterranean English, with all respect, with quite a heavy accent. And besides that, you really have to rewrite your CV because you don't sell yourself. What was the email that I got the other day? You're the most sincere headhunter I've ever worked with. Because a lot of headhunters do not take the effort. They are either afraid of the confrontation or they don't really care. But I care. I care about every candidate that I talk to. Because that's my passion for the profession.
Fantastic. I love it. So, Fredo, we could talk for the whole hour just about delivering a personal and high quality service, but I would like to, there's so much else that you have done. I'd like to move on. Thank you for those great examples. Is there anything else you can tell me about why you think you were so successful at, together with Ilonka, building Profit Power? Am I saying that?
Well, it was a It was a very profitable company, but it was Profi Power.
Oh, Profi.
Professional
okay.
Power. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Profi Power. So you built it in 5 years to 55 people. That's fast. That's rapid growth, right?
Yeah.
And then sold it, which is rare. Like most recruitment companies, A, don't scale beyond 5 or 10 people, and B, don't build a business that is sufficiently well run and robust that it would operate successfully if you removed the top tier leadership from the business. So is there anything else you think that was a secret to success there?
Ilonka and I are both very extrovert people, so we walk into a room, make contact, and we walk out with a contract often.
Okay,
so
great.
So and that's not typically Hungarian. So we are very direct, goal oriented, and that helps in doing sales, of course.
Yes.
Then I have to say that Ilonka has a fantastic international network through which we got a lot of interesting assignments.
Mm-hmm. But let me challenge you here for a second, Fredo, because most people who start or are leaders of a recruitment organization are good at selling and good at winning the work and so on. But that's very different. So I would say that is almost a prerequisite to building a successful search firm.
Yeah.
But then building and building a team, that's a whole different skill set.
Yeah, no, it's very easy.
Okay.
Very easy answer. You have to deliver. You have to do what you say. And we've always done that. And we've always been very honest and transparent in, for instance, saying, listen, what you are looking for in the market is non-existing.
Right.
Or your expectations are not realistic, and therefore we cannot do the job. But if we said we are going to deliver in time, we did it.
Right.
And I think that is the best business development you can do. That's one thing. The other thing.
Wait, just to pick up on that. So the result of that is what? More repeat business, which allows you to create demand, which requires you to grow a team. Is that the idea? Or I mean,
on the one hand, I always tell me people, excellent execution of assignments that you're working on is the best business development tool you can imagine.
Okay.
That's one. Then we organized a lot of parties all the time for our clients and candidates. So networking was key.
Can you describe
our brand?
Very
fancy parties on great locations with great live music. So we built a brand of a fancy company that everybody wanted to work for.
Oh, cool. All right.
then I also have to be very honest in the fact that in a certain way we were lucky.
Okay.
Because the period 2005, from 2005 until today, I can say that an important growth factor of the Hungarian market is the setup of shared service centers.
So Hungary
is employing more than 70,000 employees in this sector. And we have built up several centers exclusively. So also we were hit by the 2008 crisis.
I was going to say, like, you've grown and during a very adverse, like, if you look at the stock market and the economy over the last, you know, 100 years, that dip in 07, 08 was significant. And so the 5 years from 2005 to 2010 that you scaled included at least two years of economic, you know, of recession, right? So that makes the achievement all the more impressive.
Yeah, and we have had difficult times. So when the crisis hit our company in 2008, we unfortunately had to let go 25 of the 55 people.
Wow.
It was a very bad period, but we did it to save the rest of the company. So like Abit told me, if you want to save the body, you may have to take off a leg. So we had to send away quite some people, but as of January 2009, we were awarded the assignment to build up a new shared service center for a huge British multinational. And that took us out of the crisis immediately. So from 2009, January, the crisis was over for us and we started building again.
Fantastic. And, you know, coming back to what you're saying about sales and winning work, sales is the solution to many problems in business, right? And not saying it's easy in any way, but if you can proactively win profitable work, that is going to, I don't like the word recession proof, but that is going to protect your business and make it an easier recovery for you. Yeah. So could you describe what shared service center? Could you describe what that means?
So a lot of companies nowadays concentrate their back offices in a certain location, in a location where a square meter costs less and the employees have less large salaries. And by putting all those people in one location and offering, for instance, accounts payable services for the whole group, you can save a lot of money. Eh? So companies like Vodafone, BP, and companies like that, they all have shared service centers in countries like Hungary or Poland or Romania.
I get it. Okay.
And they have functions also like customer services or they're also BPOs, business process outsourcing companies that take over IT functions from companies. And all those centers require multiple language speaking people. As Hungary is a melting pot of cultures, people often speak 2-3 languages, and those are very good for the shared service centers.
Perfect. Okay, no, that makes total sense. I get it.
Yeah?
I get it now.
And
yeah.
And setting up a shared service center comes with mass recruitment.
Of course.
So I remember that in 2006, we set up the shared service center of InBev, the Brazilian beer company. We placed within a few months more than 200 people.
Wow. But let me ask you about this then, because often there's at least perceived to be a difference between the type of firm that can successfully place your leadership team and the type of firm that can successfully staff up your, you know, operation in terms of the contributors yep. And the managers. And it sounds like you do both.
Yeah.
How do you brand yourself in such a way that the client will accept that you can place a C-level or VP-level person and you yep. can and you can place, you know, a staff person?
Sharp question. I'm happy you ask it. It's the answer is very, very simple. The senior people in our company do the senior jobs, and the less senior people do the less senior jobs.
Okay.
And that has not caused any trouble to us. I have to add that this comes also from the fact that in Hungary, there are less than 10 million people, and the population is even decreasing. So it's a small country, small market. And most firms are generalist firms. So we don't see here, like in the UK, all the niche companies focusing on one type of role only or mm-hmm. one level only. So in Hungary, it's quite normal to have a wide range of seniority and type of positions. Now,
okay.
In my opinion, some companies have a too wide range. Like if you do blue-collar staffing, till CEO level, you need very, very good, let's say, even Chinese walls to separate it, and you have to brand it differently. For our company, Deep Vein and Partners, it has not caused any problem. So companies contact us for CEO positions or bookkeeper roles.
Right. Interesting. All right. Okay. No, that makes sense. Yeah. So tell me about what you're doing now then. Like you decided you wanted to start your own firm from scratch. That was in 2018. And how have you successfully grown your own practice, your own firm?
Yeah, the short answer is by following my philosophy, which is quality before quantity.
Yeah.
And the background of that is that what I often see with the big multinationals is that they want to grow the business 20-30% each year.
Yeah.
And they often do that. But I think that is not so good for the quality of the work, especially not in a small market as Hungary, where also today there's a lack of recruiters. And if there's a lack of especially good recruiters, you will end up working with bad recruiters. And if you have many colleagues on board, you need many assignments to keep them busy. Mm-hmm. This means that you will also have to accept assignments that you don't like to work on, non-exclusive or very bad jobs. And I thought, this is not going to be my path. I rather work for fewer clients with a fantastic focus on high quality than for many clients with a so-so service. So I decided to leave Randstad, where I had a great time, by the way, so I wouldn't say anything bad, but it was just not my company anymore. And my original plan was to do it completely on my own, build a firm and do 6 to 8 executive search assignments per year. And I could do that because I'm still working with clients that I started working with in 2005 and have a great life. I think they call that, what is it?
Lifestyle business?
Lifestyle business, exactly. Yeah. But life went differently because I got more and more clients and good clients I didn't want to say no to. And because of that, I started hiring people. But in order to keep those people busy, also in times when less work comes in, I had to do sales. And in fact, an important game changer was last year, 2021, February, when Abid gave me a call. Abid, as you know, is the CEO of Recruitment Entrepreneur.
Absolutely.
Having many very successful boutique firms in the portfolio. And he said, in several of our companies, there's a lack of recruitment. Like of recruiters, sources, could you help us with sourcing candidates? And we started doing that, and we're still doing it today. And among
so describe
others, because,
how does that work? So you're, in other words, part of your business. You are still serving your Hungarian clients and doing those searches with your legacy, the relationships you've got. But now
Sorry, Mark, for interrupting you.
Yeah.
No, so we also have our own international clients where we do end-to-end recruitment or executive search. But how does it work for a recruitment entrepreneur as an example? And we have more clients than that, but it's a very nice group to work with. They acquire a supply chain management role in Canada. They don't have time to work it. And they say, please do the sourcing, give us a shortlist, and from there we take over. And in some cases, the relationship is so good that we do almost end-to-end, and our recruitment entrepreneur partner only talks to the client and does the high-level communication.
Interesting. All right.
Yeah.
So, wow. So you have a portion of your is this a dedicated department or division within the business that services other recruiting firms?
Yeah, we have dedicated people, especially hired for clients like Recruitment Entrepreneur.
Great. All right, that's interesting.
Yeah, my colleagues also love it because it's more exciting than only working on Hungarian market. And so some people even work exclusively for our clients like Recruitment Entrepreneur. And I'll give you a very interesting example.
Yeah, please.
Which shows how international the market has become, and also the sourcing and recruitment profession. A colleague of mine, who is, by the way, from Jamaica, which also shows how international we are. We have colleagues from Jamaica, Norway, Jordan, Ukraine, the Netherlands, Hungary. My Jamaican colleague found for a Big Four company in Paris a French-speaking Chinese lady who happened she had already worked in the past in France, and he brought her over from China to France.
Wow. In a placement. Okay.
Well, that's what I call cross-border recruitment.
Right. Yeah. Absolutely.
And we have many of those examples. This is the most extreme one, perhaps, but this is how our business looks like today.
Wow. So based on that initial relationship with Recruitment Entrepreneur, you've now expanded that service offering and are working with other international recruitment businesses, providing the candidate. So now I would class sourcing and recruiting as almost two different functions, but it sounds like you're doing both of those. So to me, sourcing is building the, doing the market mapping, identifying the candidates, finding their contact information, putting together that candidate pool, that long list. That to me is sourcing. And then recruiting is engaging with those people, getting them interested in the role, and then doing the initial qualification. That to me is recruiting. But you're doing both of those things?
We do both. And in most cases, it starts with sourcing because they want to see how we work. But after the first assignment, they say, you don't have to restrict yourself to sourcing. Please do the recruitment engaging part as well.
Wow. Amazing.
Yeah.
That's cool. I interesting. Now, how is that commercially viable for you? Is that I'm not very familiar with Hungarian market, and presumably because if your ultimate client is, you know, charging their end client in pounds, dollars, or euros, there's sufficient margin there that they can also pay you a reasonable rate for your services and still be highly profitable, and so you both benefit. Is that the idea?
Absolutely, this is a true win-win situation. So I hope many listeners of yours to this podcast will also say, oh, man, may outsource some sourcing to Hungary, because salaries are lower than in the UK or the US. A square meter price in our offices is lower.
Okay.
In fact, most things are cheaper than in the West.
Yes.
So, and today our local currency, the forint, is also quite weak. So if we make a deal in dollars, Swiss francs, pounds, whatever, we get more nowadays than we used to get. So it is absolutely interesting for us to get a piece of the pie, because it's worth more in Hungary than it's worth in US.
Interesting. So I hadn't heard of Hungary as a market for this. I've heard of Ukraine before the war, yep. Romania, and then of course we find really good people in the Philippines for our company. Traditionally, you know, India, Pakistan, but I hadn't heard of outsourcing to Hungary. But so you've opened my mind to a whole opportunity here.
Yeah, and we have to thank Abid for this because he came up with the idea.
Yeah, well, there you go. He's a very creative, opportunistic. Like he comes up with ways of making money, right? That's one of his strengths. Fantastic. This is really interesting. So, what are your plans now for continuing to grow the business, Frido?
Yeah, now, we would like to expand our executive search service, mm-hmm. both locally and internationally. Because we're good at it, we get very good testimonials, and we love to deal with it. It's my favorite activity. Looking for general managers, CFOs, I love to do it anywhere in the world. My colleagues are also growing up, so to speak. So more and more colleagues are able to do that. And I listened to a podcast of yours where the question was raised: is a young person also able to do executive search? Yes, if smart and business savvy enough. And I have several colleagues who are perfectly capable of doing it. And of course, executive search comes with the nicest commitment of clients, the nicest fees. And I often say it's easier to place a CEO than a French English speaking accounts receivable clerk.
Right. Yeah. No, absolutely. Yeah. I would agree.
Yeah, so that's what we're going to grow. That I want to grow, one of the tools to do that is of course the social selling, and this podcast is also an example of that. So thank you for the opportunity.
My pleasure.
Our recruitment business, as such, there's so much left for us, also on the Hungarian market, because I often hear from companies that we take over from large multinationals, that at the big companies, they often don't get the attention they are looking for. They don't get the treatment. So there's still a lot to win for us there. The RPO type of service that we offer. So for some companies, we completely take over the recruitment part. And for other companies, it's sourcing only. Next week I will have a strategic meeting with my management, and then we will talk about where to specialize, because I do see a big advantage in specializing in certain fields and deepening the knowledge. For certain fields, we can remain generalists, because until the business is good, why stop with it? But I do feel that there's a need to specialize in some areas. And next
definitely,
week,
we're
going to decide
that.
What those areas will be. I said I want to stay in this business until I die. But okay. but it's good to build up something that's also sellable after a while, of course.
Totally. 100%. Two more quick questions, Frido. One is, if people listening are interested in learning more about your RPO service for recruitment companies, what's the best way of them reaching out to you?
Well, through our website, or calling me or writing to me. Well, my name is, of course, a bit difficult for non-Dutch speakers. But all information can be found on our webpage. And
okay.
I guess you will add that.
We will add that link. But if someone's in their car driving and they're not writing it down, maybe they finding you on LinkedIn is the shortcut.
Yeah, and there's not so many Frido's on LinkedIn.
F-R-I-D-O.
Yeah, F-R-I-D-O. There are other Frido's than myself, but they're not involved in recruitment. So as far as I know, there's only one Frido recruiter.
Okay,
and,
excellent.
And if you add to that Budapest, then you can't miss me.
Okay, fantastic. Well, I will... we'll definitely link to you in the show notes, Frido. And this has been fantastic. I feel like we've only scratched the surface. There's a lot more we could talk about. So let's say to be continued. And meanwhile, I wish you the best of luck with your continued expansion.
Thank you very much. Same to you. Your podcasts are really inspiring. I've listened to many of them already, and I learned from it. And of course, that's also an important purpose of this podcast. Inspiring and learning.
I appreciate that. Yeah. I appreciate that very much, Frido. Enjoy the rest of your day and look forward to our next chat.
You too, Mark.